I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Before the Mondavi Winery became a powerhouse, wine drinking in this country was considered an immigrant custom from the old country. The story of this family is a fascinating tale. I'll tell you about it today on the show. And beer drinking women, it happens less than you think. I'll tell you why. What's a fluff duff or a pig vest? These and other cowboy food items defined. And is it criminal to make your baby a vegan? How this diet can affect infants. But first, as always, let's get to the market to see what's in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It is a very exciting time at the farmer's market. Our very short season mango crop is in at the Wednesday farmer's market. This is a wonderful specialty crop that comes in from the Salton Sea. It's grown by the Wong family farm. They are the ones that bring us in hydroponic tomatoes early in the season. Today we are visiting with David Karp, who's going to tell us a lot of interesting information about these wonderful mangoes. So David, tell us what varieties they have to start with.
One is Valencia Pride, which is large, yellowish, and probably the sweetest and most delicate, most intensely flavored of all the mangoes. There's the Kit, which tends to be greenish, and that's a standard commercial variety, but a very high-quality one.
And let's talk about stringiness, because the one thing we love about the Kit is there are no strings.
That's right. The main variety that's grown commercially and available in the United States, the Tommy Atkins, produces like a champ. It's disease-resistant. It ships well. There's only one problem. The flavor is nil, and the stringiness is abominable. There's another couple of problems. When mangoes, obviously, are great in the tropics, because they have the perfect weather for it in Mexico or South America. But when they ship them here, most of them have to be subjected to hot water treatment for phytosanitary purposes. That's to kill the insects or sterilize the insects. That parboils them. The flavor and texture are never the same, and particularly the aroma is never the same. There's another thing that nobody knows about. I don't think I've ever even written about this, but most of the mangoes that are grown in the tropics are treated with paclobutrazole, which is a growth regulator that enables them to flower all at the same time or flower more regularly. Now, that doesn't do any harm to the flavor.
What about the people who eat it?
Well, the people who apply it. It's banned in the United States. I don't think that there are any residues because it's sprayed early on just before the trees even flower. But here's the thing. In order to use this technique, they have to apply a huge amount of nitrogen, and that really screws the flavor. It renders the mangoes very fibrous and dilutes the flavor. Anyway, let's get back to the Wong mangoes.
Okay,
I visited the farm when they had just planted the mangoes and then when they first started to bear a crop, and so it really has an emotional resonance to me to see that these mangoes survived, because most of the mangoes were destroyed in a freeze, the worst freeze since 1937.
The citrus freeze that we had this spring.
Half of the commercial plantings were killed to the ground. There's no particular reason that I can think of why Debbie's crop shouldn't have been very adversely affected too, because her tomatoes right next door were absolutely devastated. But the miracle of the mangoes, her survived, and it's more than just economic for her, because it was the dream of her father, Ed, to grow mangoes in the desert. He died, alas, before the trees ever fruited, but that's why there's sentimental value as well as commercial value to these mangoes.
So how does he do it? Is it irrigation? Is it getting enough water to them?
They've got to get a lot of water, and believe it or not, the Wongs actually have to pay city rates. So they're not getting ag rates. They could only do this by selling them at $3 a pound at the Santa Monica farmers markets.
Okay, let's talk about how we cut it, eat it, and handle it.
You don't want to buy a mango that's super soft unless you're going to eat it right that very moment, because when a mango ripens on the tree, it actually becomes gelatinized near the pit, which is not ideal for flavor or texture.
Okay, and then eat it when it's just soft to the touch.
That's
just
right.
Just starting to give.
And the classical way is to hold the mango with its nose at the top and then use a knife to slice off the cheek on one horizontal side and then another horizontal side. This is the case where picture would be worth 1,000 words.
It's got that flat seed in the middle.
Yeah.
Right.
And then you cross-hatch it on the side that you've cut and then fold it open and eat over a sink.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or cut them off if you're the delicate sort.
And now the Kit and the Valencia Pride, now these are they available in grocery stores or not?
Kit is widely available as imported from Latin America. Valencia Pride, you can only get in home gardens.
Oh.
And at the Wongs right here. And they're only going to have it for like another week or two, because that's relatively early. The season's like late July and early August. They should have kits. Didn't ask them, but I think they should have them for at least several weeks.
All right. And so the moral of the story here is get here early to get these fabulous mangoes. And if you haven't tried a stringless mango, if you want to eat a mango that's not going to get stuck in your teeth, it's an amazing experience. They are delicious, too.
To me, it's the aroma that's really special from these mangoes. But get here early. They sold out today by 9 o'clock because the restaurants scoop them up. I'd be here next Wednesday by 8:30.
David, as always, thank you so much. That was David Karp. He is the fruit detective. His article on mangoes appears in the August issue of Sunset.
Sunset Magazine.
Yeah. It's on newsstands, I guess, now?
Right now.
If you want to learn more about mangoes and if you want to taste one, just get on down here to the Wednesday Market and get here early. This time of year is also the best season for the wonderful summer heirloom tomatoes we've all been waiting for. Just for an example, I was just standing by Ed Munak's stand here at the Wednesday Market. He has an orange oxheart. He's got a purple Marisol. He's got this wonderful tomato that he named a Caltrans because it's a brilliant orange, and it's one of the sweetest tomatoes I've tasted all year. A Crazy Zebra, which is a striped multicolored. He's got the great Green Zebra, a beautiful purple Cherokee, a pure orange large persimmon tomato. It's called persimmon. It's persimmon color. And then a gorgeous multicolored orange and red and yellow pineapple tomato, which is just great sliced on a plate. And then the beautiful little round Celebrity. And these are all heirloom tomatoes grown outdoors. And the flavors, the colors, the textures, mixed together, eaten alone, it's just a fantastic time to just gobble down tons of tomatoes. So come on out and enjoy it. Get your fresh basil. Go get some eggplant. Get your squash. It's summer. It's great. Come on down and check out these farmers. It's just too good to miss. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
My latest cooking videos up on iTunes and our website. I've got two really easy and delicious ways to prepare porcini mushrooms. Check it out and let me know what you think. Find it at kcrw.com/goodfood. Jonathan Gold is here next. He's Good Food's favorite omnivore and the Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic for the LA Weekly. That's when Good Food returns. That fabulous time once again, where we turn to Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of countless counterintelligence columns in the LA Weekly, for where to go eat today. And I have to tell you, Jonathan, that we've had some requests for a vegetarian alternative to turn away from the pig, just for a brief moment. Do you have something for us?
Sure. Not only vegetarian, but kosher.
Ooh, think of that.
It's in Tarzana, and it's the Hummus Bar.
Okay, so it's a restaurant that sells hummus.
Correct.
Describe what hummus is.
Hummus is the ubiquitous Middle Eastern spread of pureed chickpeas and tahini, which is basically a sesame paste. Mixed together, delightful, wonderful, a side dish in every single Middle Eastern meal you'll ever go to.
And one of the most satisfying things to eat ever.
It's delicious.
It's delicious. Okay, so the Hummus Bar, is it, when I hear the word bar, I think that I'm given a base of some kind and I walk around putting stuff on top of it.
There's something like that. You can order regular hummus. You can order hummus with extra tahini. You can order hummus with different things on it. And often the different things on the hummus are constituents of hummus. For example, there's one with extra stewed chickpeas on it, which are very, very soft.
Must be delicious.
And which sort of, you know, melt into it when you mix it all together. There's like a vegetable salad that you can get on it. There's a very spicy tomato sauce that's cooked down so it's thick. And then they put it over poached eggs and then the hummus.
Yum. I'm intrigued by the hummus with extra tahini. You, of course, ordered that, right?
Yeah, sure.
And it's already mixed in. It isn't, or do they just slather a tahini sauce on top of the hummus?
Well, it's the hummus at Hummus Bar is presented somewhat differently from most places. There's a chickpea puree, and then there's the tahini on top. So as you eat the hummus, you're mixing it yourself. And so every bite is subtly different, and it makes you actually power through a bowl of the stuff, which means that a hummus actually feels like lunch instead of like a tiny part of a lunch.
Do they put a lot of garlic in the chickpea puree?
It's garlicky, but it's not like glaze your teeth garlicky. And unlike most places in town, which I assume use mixes, I mean, everything's super fresh. So this, you know, tahini's ground fresh from sesame and the chickpea is ground from chickpeas.
From home stewed chickpeas, which
right.
I have to say, for people who have never done this at home, mm-hmm. the difference between a canned chickpea and a simmered, beautifully watched chickpea, huge, huge difference.
Oh, yeah. There's no question. Israeli people in Los Angeles, one of the things they're always complaining about is that there's no place to get hummus. And I've always listened to them and sort of rolled my eyes and, yeah, hummus, whatever. But, I mean, this is really good hummus. I mean, I think probably the only hummus I've ever had that was better was the one that they are serving on the tasting menu at Spago now in place of foie gras.
You're kidding.
No.
Oh, that's so funny.
And if the hummus is going to take the place of the foie gras, it better be good hummus.
That's true. Okay, so hummus bar in Tarzana, are there any other accompaniments or any other dishes, or is it just really all about the hummus?
You can get falafel.
Oh, that must be good there.
The falafel is pretty good. It's very much fried. It's not healthy falafel. It's very green and herby inside. I assume that they do it fresh since they're grinding so many chickpeas anyway.
And you eat a copious amount of pita bread as an accompaniment?
There's a lot of pita bread. It's a different kind. It's not home-baked, unfortunately, but it's a sort of puffier pita bread, more like a raised bread than like a thin envelope.
So give us the address and any other specs you have.
Hummus Bar is at 18743 Ventura Boulevard in Tarzana. And as it's a kosher restaurant, it's closed Friday nights and Saturdays.
Fabulous. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
The LA Weekly is where you can read Jonathan Gold's weekly ruminations on food in LA. And here on Good Food is where you can hear him almost every week. Next week, KCRW's Pledge Drive begins. If you subscribe during Good Food next week, we'll send you a year's worth of John Gold's recommendations. We've got so much other great stuff for you, too, so don't miss us live next week at 11 a.m. It's not until you're charged with feeding children that you realize how impossible it is to please picky eaters. A lot of us started out that way, but we grew out of it. There are scores of adults, though, who are so confined in their diet that it affects their social lives. Why some people only eat 10 foods. That's next when Good Food continues. Good Food, we love to talk about food. We love to discover new flavors and adventures in cuisine. But there's some people for whom trying a new food would be a truly harrowing experience. Marcy Levin-Pelshaw of the Monell Institute is here to talk about picky eaters. How do you define a picky eater?
There are a number of characteristics that define picky eater. One of them is that they eat a very small number of different foods. Some of them say that they eat 20 or fewer different foods.
Do picky eaters tend to reject an entire class of foods, or is it that they eat foods that are just served completely plain?
Both. It's common for picky eaters not to eat any vegetables, for example, but they also tend to like very plain foods. Another characteristic is that they show food neophobia, which we define, well, literally it means fear of new foods.
Are there certain categories of foods that picky eaters tend to dislike? For example, is it more about taste or is it often very focused on texture?
Texture is definitely a more important factor than taste. They're worried about sliminess, about cartilaginousness.
I've had the experience of some people being freaked by tomatoes because when you cut open the slice and there's that gel part of a tomato, just seems to just freak some people out.
Yes, that's kind of interesting because American cuisine these days revolves around tomato products, but many of those, like ketchup, are cooked and have a very homogeneous texture. The fresh tomato itself, which is still fairly ubiquitous, has a lot of different textures. It has that slimy stuff around the seeds. It has the skin. It has the flesh, which can be grainy. So there are a surprising number of adults in the United States who don't eat raw tomatoes.
What about lumps? Like, I mean, the easiest way to think of it is like a porridge with lumps or something added in, like a plain muffin versus a muffin that had, like, you know, dried cranberries in it.
Yes, we call those inclusions. And picky eaters frequently don't like inclusions. A big exception is chocolate chips, though. Everybody likes them.
I would imagine that as an adult picky eater, having to go to a business cocktail party would probably be sort of the worst.
Right. A cocktail party is a real nightmare because of enclosed foods, foods wrapped in dough, which most of us like, dumplings, egg rolls, you name it. But for a picky eater, that's very frightening. It's hard to tell what's inside.
Wow. Should we care? I mean, so if they only eat 10 things, is that necessarily a bad thing?
Well, in terms of nutrition, child picky eaters do tend to be smaller. Adult picky eaters do not tend to be smaller than other adults. In fact, it's just the contrary. Because many of the foods that they're comfortable with are high in caloric density, they tend to have a higher BMI than other types of eaters.
Are there simple treatments that can be done to introduce a larger number of foods to the picky eater?
For children, what we tell parents is to be good role models themselves, to show an interest in food, and also to continue to expose the child to a food, even if he or she rejects it the first time. With adult picky eaters, it's a little harder for someone else to apply treatment without that individual's cooperation.
Can they be cured?
There have been some reports in the literature of success in treating picky eaters. Certain types of medications that help with OCD and depression. The problem is that most picky eaters don't seek out treatment. One of them tried to explain this to us, and he said, well, imagine if I told you that I could give you a pill that would make you want to eat feces. Would you take it? My answer would be no. And what that reveals is that to him, these foods that he doesn't include in his diet are very disgusting and frightening.
My goodness, I'm so grateful I'm not a picky eater. How about you?
I am not picky at all. That is why I'm so fascinated with them.
Well, thank you so much, Marcy.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
The Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia is where Marcia Pelshot does her work. It's doing some amazing research on taste, smell, and chemical irritation. I've got a link on our site to their site at kcrw.com/goodfood. Kids are the world's pickiest eaters, but can parents impose their own restrictions on their kids? Like, can you make your infant baby into a vegan? Parents have gone to jail for neglect for doing so. Next, some sense on what nutrients developing bodies need and where to find them. That's coming up on Good Food. all of us, of course, want our newborn babies to thrive. For some, it would make sense that the best diet, in addition to breast milk, is the diet that we ourselves embrace. But what happens when a committed vegan mom doesn't have all the information she needs? Nina Plank writes about food issues on her blog, but it was her article in the New York Times on vegan baby death that caused an uproar. Tell us about the case that prompted you to write about vegan baby diets.
There were a couple of cases that caught my attention, and in each of these cases, committed vegan parents were convicted of some or another crime because their babies were malnourished. And I think that ignorance probably had a lot to do with the suffering of these babies, but they did get me thinking about some political correctness, I think, when we speak of human nutrition. Because from my studies about traditional diets, I've concluded that a vegan diet is simply not good enough for babies.
We should say that you yourself are a former vegan.
I was a vegan and a vegetarian and have done a lot of research since on what traditional human diets look like and what human nutrition requires.
So what are some of the essentials a baby can miss out on if it's fed a strict vegan diet?
Well, let's start by defining what a vegan diet is. It means coming from plant foods only, and so it wouldn't include any animal products. That means no meat, of course, and no fish, and no dairy and eggs, and some vegan parents don't approve of honey because it comes from insects. The best way, I think, to think about what a vegan baby misses out on is to look at human breast milk. And responsible vegan parents do breastfeed their babies, and of course that's the right thing to do. Breast milk is very rich in fats. It's rich in saturated fats. It contains protein. It contains milk sugars. And it contains a lot of cholesterol. It contains omega-3 fats called DHA and EPA. These are long-chain essential fatty acids, which are absolutely essential for brain and eye development. So it stands to reason that your infant needs all these nutrients, and none of those nutrients are particularly easy to get from plant foods, or the sources, the plant sources of them are not as good as the animal sources.
Well, what about soy? People will often respond to these kind of conversations by saying, well, there's soy baby formula.
What a good question, and soy brings me to another worry. We have been watching soy formula for 30 or 40 years try to duplicate even the superior nutrients in dairy formula, that is cow milk-based formula. And what you see is a whole history of the soy industry noting that soy formula stunts growth. What are we going to do about it? Noting that soy protein is incomplete. What are we going to do about it? Noting that soy contains phytic acid and other things that are called anti-nutrients. And so they reduce your absorption of protein and calcium. Noting that soy lacks vitamin A and vitamin D, which you find in breast milk and in cow milk. What are we going to do about it? You can see for all these reasons that soy doesn't even begin to resemble the food that a baby is getting from either a breast milk, which is ideal, or a dairy or meat-based formula.
What about breast milk from a vegan mom?
There are some concerns there, and one has to do with DHA. This is the long-chain omega-3 fat that is found chiefly in fish oil. And in a book by Dr. Andrew Stoll called The Omega-3 Connection, which I highly recommend for any vegan or vegetarian mother who would like to get pregnant or is nursing, there is a study showing that vegan breast milk contains less DHA. Now, this is worrisome because DHA is not just conditionally essential, to use a sort of geeky nutritional term, which means you can get by without it if you're getting something else, or you can find it in a plant source, but your body converts it, but absolutely essential. That is, the body has to have DHA.
Do you believe, after all the research you've done, do you think there's such a thing as a healthy vegan pregnancy?
I don't think a vegan pregnancy and nursing is a responsible course to take. I think that if you are an otherwise healthy adult and you were well-nourished, then with external supplements, you might have a passably healthy vegan diet. But I cannot recommend it for babies, and they don't have a choice.
What were the responses that you got? Were people really angry with you for bringing this up?
There was an overwhelming response, and it's true that much of it was personal and vicious. And there was a high degree of cynicism, which surprised me. People wanted to know, am I paid by the meat or dairy industry? I'm not. But then I got a lot of positive mail as well, a lot of former vegans, former vegetarians. In the August edition of Food and Wine, there's an interesting piece about some famous vegetarians like Molly Katzen, who wrote the Moosewood cookbooks, now becoming what I call ethical omnivores. It's interesting, I think, that insofar as I had ethical and ecological concerns about eating meat and dairy, in addition to nutritional concerns, that I was then able to reassure myself on those points by finding meat and dairy that comes from ecological and humane sources.
Do you think that vegetarianism can sustain a healthy pregnancy, one that's a little more wide that involves some dairy?
I think it can if you're consuming dairy and or eggs. But I still think it falls short of ideal. Here, at least, we can see that traditional human populations, such as in India, have sustained fertility and reproduction and health generation after generation on lacto-vegetarian diets, that is, containing milk but not eggs. You would be able to get some of the essential fats, the vitamin B12, which is found only in animal foods, and vitamins A and D, which are found fully formed in one the body can use only in animal foods. So I would recommend that. My main concern with a vegetarian pregnancy is the lack of fish oil. You can get some of these fats from plant sources, but your body has to convert them into longer chain fats. That conversion is regarded as somewhat costly and imperfect. And so fish oil really is the best source. Happily now, they're producing some DHA supplements from algae. I have not seen studies to suggest that those are cheap, safe, and effective like fish oil is. I hope they are for the sake of vegetarians. Just add one other thing. The body has huge protein requirements during pregnancy. The baby will create his body out of your own protein, your own fats, your own vitamins. He will just deplete your body because that's his job, is to grow his own body. And he'll take the fish oil straight out of your brain, and it'll go into your breast milk when you're nursing. And a lack of adequate fish oil is one of the main nutritional reasons for postnatal depression in new mothers.
Nina, it's so interesting. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Real Food, What to Eat and Why is Nina Plank's book. Nina recently wrote a New York Times op-ed piece on vegan baby deaths. Before the House of Mondavi, wine drinking was a foreign concept in this country. Robert Mondavi is credited with starting the wine revolution and changing the way Americans view and drink it. The story of this family-run business is fraught with tales. I'll tell some of them next. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Maybe you've heard of Robert Mondavi. Perhaps you've had a glass of Mondavi Chardonnay, or you may have even been to the Mondavi Winery for a wine tasting. But you just might be surprised to know all that went on behind the scenes at the Mondavi Winery in its heyday. Julia Flynn Seiler has spent countless hours unearthing the secrets of the Mondavi wine family for her book, The House of Mondavi, and she's here to share some of them with us today. Give us an idea of what Napa Valley was like before Robert Mondavi came onto the scene.
Robert Mondavi ended up in the Napa Valley in the late 30s, shortly before the war began. And at that time, Napa Valley was just as lush as it is today, but it was mostly growing crops such as prune trees and walnuts. Grapevines were unusual, and there were only perhaps a half dozen or so big wineries, some of which had become ghost wineries, like the old Charles Krug winery that the Mondavi family eventually ended up buying in the late 30s.
What's a ghost winery?
A ghost winery is a winery that has been abandoned. And in the case of Charles Krug, well, it was one of the most famous names in California winemaking at the turn of the century.
What were Americans drinking at this time? Was wine a part of the meal?
No, no. Wine was considered in the 30s and 40s and 50s an immigrant's beverage. It was a lower class drink.
And what was it about Robert Mondavi that began the conversation of a different place in our lives for food and wine?
Well, Robert Mondavi went to France in the early 60s and had an epiphany, had a wonderful experience dining at one of the most famous French restaurants at the time. He describes experiencing a sole floating in butter paired with a beautiful, delicate white Bordeaux. And all of a sudden it came to him that wine paired with food was a beautiful experience and should be embraced by Americans. It wasn't just an immigrant's beverage anymore.
Well, of course, this immigrant business turned into a big business and a cultural phenomenon. And this family in particular seems to have been beset by drama and conflict. When you started working on your research, did you have any idea the depths of the discord and scandal you were going to find?
No, not at all. My research began as reporting for a Wall Street Journal story. What I set out to understand was why Michael Mondavi, Robert's eldest son, would have been ousted as chairman of the family-controlled company.
What was the rift that seems to be at the center of all of this drama?
Well, ironically, perhaps the saddest part of it is that Charles Krug Winery was run by the boys, Peter Mondavi and Robert Mondavi. Those were the sons of Cesare Mondavi, and Cesare was the family patriarch who had traveled from Italy in 1906. And Cesare Mondavi had placed one condition on the purchase of the Charles Krug Winery, and that was that his two boys work together. Robert, the oldest son, charismatic, a great salesperson, and Peter, the more introverted winemaker. And while Cesare was alive, they worked together pretty well. But once he died in 1959, the simmering resentment, the sibling rivalry between these two sons exploded, and in particular exploded one day in 1965. And there was a family gathering. There was a dispute between the brothers over the purchase, Robert's purchase of a mink coat for his wife, Marjorie. And what had happened was that Robert had been invited, along with his wife, to the Kennedy White House as a representative of a very successful Italian-American family. And, of course, Robert wanted his wife to look lovely. And so they went shopping and they bought this mink coat. And, you know, this is a small family business at this point. He's not paid a lot of money. And he ended up expensing this very, very costly mink coat with fully intending to pay the money back to the company. Well, we all know we're all parts of families and we know how small things can turn into big things very quickly. And what happened was that Peter seemed to imply that Robert had stolen from the company by putting this mink coat on his expense account. And Robert got very angry at this implication and told him to take it back, and he wouldn't. And so Robert threw a punch at him and then threw another punch at him. And by one account, these two brothers, both in their 50s, ended up rolling around in the dust. And Robert apparently, you know, got his hands around Peter's neck. And when Peter went back and saw Mama Rosa, the family matriarch at that point, she was furious at her firstborn child. And to make a long story short, meted out old world justice and banished Robert from the family business. He went about 5 miles down the road and started what was called the Robert Mondavi Winery with the help of a number of friends. A few years pass, Robert Mondavi changes the pronunciation of his name from Mondavi, which was the Americanized version that Cesare had adopted, to Mondavi, the more European-sounding pronunciation of the name. Yet there still were conflicts between the two rival wineries. And eventually, Robert Mondavi sued his mother, Rosa, who was then in her 80s, and his brother and his two sisters for his share of the family fortune. That family fortune was locked in the original Charles Krug Winery. And they battled for years. I mean, there was lawsuits and countersuits, and it went back and forth for almost a decade. Finally went to trial in 1976 and became one of the most famous court cases in California history. And eventually Robert was fully vindicated by the judge. He won, and he got his share of the family fortune.
What's the status of the Mondavi Winery now? Who runs it?
Well, the Robert Mondavi Winery was taken over, purchased by Constellation Brands in late 2004. And that is what the House of Mondavi documents, is how a seemingly takeover-proof family-controlled company, in fact, was taken over against the wishes of many of the family shareholders. And ironically, the Constellation Company is run by a pair of brothers themselves, also publicly traded wine company. And so they sold out, the family sold out for more than $1 billion, but it was very emotional, and many of them really didn't want to sell.
Julia, thank you so much. It's a really interesting book.
Thank you, Evan. I appreciate being on the show.
Julia Flynn Seiler's book is House of Mondavi, The Rise and Fall of an American Wine Dynasty. Women actually buy most of the wine in the U.S. and a lot of the beer, but they don't seem to drink all of it that much. The Beer Chick's doing her best to change that. Coming up next on Good Food, why beer and women don't mix. What is it about being a woman who likes beer that makes people look at you kind of funny? I commiserate right now with Christina Perosi, otherwise known as the Beer Chick. Christina is a beer sommelier. She blogs on the subject of beer and is writing a book titled Beer for Chicks. So what is it about women and beer that seems to denote a very particular sort of image?
Generally, when people think of women and beer, they're thinking of the Bud Girl, you know, they're thinking of the bikinis. And, you know, I always used to say, if you see some bikini-clad women around and Sparks and Monster guitar chords, you're probably in a beer commercial somewhere.
See, to me, the association is more like cutoffs, a halter top with feathers hanging off of it, and down in dirty boots.
That's a very good image as well, because I think there's a huge masculinization of beer. You know, we all know that men drink more beer than women do, but I think that it's because of the marketing of beer and that it's been marketed towards the male sexual fantasy. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But it tells that women would, you know, and a modern, intelligent, sophisticated woman would kind of run screaming from those images. So to me...
And run towards wine.
Exactly, which I think is kind of feminized. I think that, you know, women feel good about, you know, holding a big, pretty goblet, and they don't realize that those things that can exist and do exist in the beer world as well.
During your time serving beer, have you seen a difference in the way women respond to it? Do you have to talk them into it sometimes?
Yes, I do. And actually, a lot of women don't already like beer when they get there. They're like, I'm not a beer drinker. I call it denial. They always ask me for something light. I'd like something light. Please give me something light.
And what do they mean? Light in calories or light in flavor?
They mean both. I think that definitely they mean light in calories, because there's a misconception that beer has more calories than wine, which it doesn't. And they also want something light in flavor, because traditionally they've been exposed to mass-produced, industrialized beers that all are made with bad ingredients. And so, of course, if you think that something tastes bad, you're going to want to taste less of it. So,
do you have any particular memories of an experience with turning a chick onto beer that just made you feel great?
That's why I started doing what I'm doing, because so many people would come up to me at Father's office and they would say, I want a light beer, or I don't know anything about beer, or I'm not a beer drinker. And the first thing I would say to them is like, well, wait, what kind of flavors do you like? You know, do you like something toasty? Do you like something nutty? Do you like something chocolatey? Do you like something fruity? Because all of these spicy, all of these flavors exist in beer. And once they tasted it, their eyes would just shine. They were just, you know, exposed to a whole world. But actually, you know, the thing that kind of bothers me, you know, we talk about women and beer and men and beer, is that men really don't know beer either. You know, men know as little about beer beyond, you know, the mass-produced beers as women do.
Do you find that women gravitate to a certain flavor profile of beer compared to men?
I think initially they do. I think that women have better palates than men do. Sorry, guys. I think that women take more time in assessing a beer because they're a little bit afraid of it. And I think that initially, once you've turned a woman on to a life beyond the mass-produced beers, then she's more likely to explore beyond the first beer that she had.
And what is often the first beer that you'll present to a woman who's never really had beer before?
Well, I believe in baby steps. So I don't want to shock anybody, but it really depends on what they've told me they like. I'll ask them a few questions. And if I realize what they really want is a light, nuanced lager, I might do something like, you know, like Craftsman 1903, something like that.
You brought a little sampling. Could we just go through the beers that you brought and tell
Sure.
me why you picked those in particular?
So I brought the Modite.
Now, we should say that Unibrew is a producer.
Right. And I brought this because of what I call beer myth number one, and that's that a dark beer is bitter and heavy. The only thing that the color of a beer tells you is to what degree the malt has been roasted that was used in the making of this beer. It tells you nothing about the alcohol content, nothing about the sweetness or the bitterness. It tells you nothing about the, you know, how heavy it's going to be. It only tells you what kind of malt they used. It might give you a little indication that there might be some toasty or roasty notes in it, but that's about it. We always used to say, you know, don't judge a beer by its color.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And this I brought as an example that a dark beer can taste in ways that you wouldn't ever expect. And so this is a very sweet vinous, you know, beer with dark fruits and, you know, clovey, nutmeg.
Now, this next one I don't think I've ever tasted.
So this beer is from Deschutes Breweries out of Bend, Oregon. It's called Inversion IPA.
Now, IPA means?
IPA means India Pale Ale. And it's kind of an interesting story. You know, each beer style, that's the other reason why I'm really fascinated by beer also, because it, to me, it's like cultural anthropology. It's beers are made in a certain way because of where they're from, you know, what their climate is like, what their history was, who it was drinking it, who it was making it, where it was going to, where it was coming from. So India Pale Ale is a beer that is always hoppier and has a higher alcohol content than a pale ale. And by hoppier, I mean bitter.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring this as an example of what women are most afraid of in beer.
That's so, I guess that's true. I think that it's interesting because we drink so much coffee in mm-hmm. this country. You would think we wouldn't be afraid of bitter beers. But then I guess most of the coffee a lot of people are drinking is diluted with milk and has a lot of sweet things in it.
Exactly.
So, Christina, do you offer beer classes or tastings for women?
I do. I do beer tastings around town and usually announce those on my website. I've been writing for Draft Magazine, and I'm currently writing an article about music and beer pairing.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming by.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You can find Christina Perozzi at her website, ChristinaPerozzi.com. We'll have a link on our site at KCRW.com/goodfood. So what the heck is a pig vest or a fluff duff? They're cowboy speak. I'll be back next with some of the cowboys who made a name for themselves cooking in the outdoors. Stay tuned to Good Food. About cowboys is that they're so sexy with their boots and their hat and their swagger. But I think they're even more sexy because when I think of cowboys, I think of men who cook. Now, Rob Walsh is the restaurant critic of the Houston Press, and he has served as a commentator on NPR's Weekend Edition and as a food columnist for Natural History. He has a lot to say about cowboys and eats. How you doing, Rob?
I'm doing great. I'm swaggering. I'm trying to swagger.
Give me a list of some classic cowboy groceries.
Well, you know, writing about cowboy food is a very complex thing to do because on the one hand, you have the mythic cowboy, which in culinary terms is the cowboy of the chuck wagon with beans and bacon and biscuits and steaks and so forth. And but then on the other hand, you have the reality of the cowboy. And the reality is that cowboys were black and Hispanic and from all different ethnic groups. They bear little resemblance to what Hollywood has given us. And in the last 20, 30 years, all of these groups have, you know, Hispanics and blacks and women have come forward and said, hey, we had a big part, you know, to play in the Western heritage. You know, how come we're not being acknowledged? So in light of this sort of revisionist history, I think what I try to do in the Texas Cowboy Cookbook is tell the story of not just the mythic cowboy, you've got to address that, but moreover of this new kind of multicultural image of the cowboy, which has emerged recently, which means that if 25 to 40% of cowboys in Texas were black, which they were at one time, that means that African-American food, that okra and cane syrup and yams and all those wonderful foods were a big part of cowboy cuisine, too.
So talking about black cowboys in Texas, who was Nat Love?
Nat Love actually wrote a book about being a cowboy. Its title, I can't remember because it's about 50 words long, being the real life adventures of so on and so forth. But he was a famous cowboy who set down his story.
Did he talk a little bit about the cuisine?
No, it's, you know, cowboys, especially Nat Love, who was trying to sort of set history straight as far as the contributions that blacks have made, didn't spend much time talking about what they ate. And historians tell us that in the trail drive era, cowboys were probably eating beans, fatback, as our bacon was called back then, coffee and biscuits, and that was about it.
You used the words cane syrup a little while back. Now, I know that there's also a thing called cane vinegar. Was it used much in cooking, and do you have a good recipe for us?
Oh, absolutely. Cane sugar, in East Texas, everybody grew ribbon cane, which was a kind of sugar cane, and you took it down to the local sugar mill where they crushed the cane into cane juice, and then that cane juice was cooked down in a big syrup pan. You split your syrup 50-50 with the mill, and that was your sweetener. So just about everything in the early days of East Texas cattle ranching, all of the sweetener was cane syrup. The most beautiful and simple recipe I can give you is a layer of sliced sweet potatoes baked with cane sugar on top and a little butter in between. Absolutely spectacular. The other great recipe I can give you is take your pecan pie and throw away the Cairo corn syrup and use cane syrup instead. And oh my word, what a difference.
Describe the flavor of cane syrup versus something like molasses or Cairo syrup.
Cane syrup is like halfway to molasses. If you take the commercial process by which molasses is made, where you cook down cane juice until it's thick and black like that, if you stopped it about halfway, you'd be at cane syrup. So cane syrup has a tang of molasses, but it's not quite that strong, and it doesn't have that sulfur kind of taste. It's a beautiful flavor. Steen's cane syrup in Louisiana still, you know, sells. We still buy that in the supermarket, and you can get it online. Steen's also sells a cane vinegar.
Tell me a recipe that you have that uses cane vinegar.
Well, Mama Sugar, who is this wonderful black cowgirl cook who I met in Fresno, Texas, she does a grilled pork chop recipe where she marinades the pork chops in cane vinegar first. And, you know, it's like, well, you know, what is that going to do? But, oh, my word, the flavor. First of all, the flavor is wonderful, but it seems to have she claims it tenderizes the pork chops, and I think she's probably right. What you do is you turn the pork chops in the cane vinegar, and you let them sit for a while, and then you come back and put your pork rub on it, salt, pepper, sugar, and then you grill it, and the flavor's out of this world.
Wow, it sounds delicious. Now, was there any cowgirl who was also known for her culinary prowess? I'm thinking about maybe Hallie Stillwell.
Well, yeah, it's funny because Hallie Stillwell wouldn't want to be known for her culinary prowess. Hallie Stillwell wanted to be known for the fact that she shot a mountain lion and that she rode with the cowboys and, you know, that she was just as good a cowboy as they were. But you know, when Hallie got pregnant and had kids, she found herself stuck at home, as she would put it. And then she had to start cooking, you know, just to keep from going crazy.
What was one of her most famous dishes?
Hallie was, one thing she was famous for was scrubbing out her husband's coffee pot, which drove him crazy because the cowboy legend was that you never cleaned the coffee pot, that just ruined the flavor. And she was famous for ruining the flavor of the coffee. But she was also famous for picking a bunch of peaches and coming home and making peach pie and peach cobbler and the things that the cowboys called dainties. When women finally came out to West Texas and, you know, turned the ranch house into a, you know, a more domestic place, then we started to see fruit pies, more often buttermilk pies, because there weren't a lot of fruit trees in West Texas, and buttermilk pie became famous not because everybody loved buttermilk so much, but because they didn't have any fruit to work with.
Oh, that's fascinating. Rob, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thanks a lot.
Hey, my pleasure.
That was author Rob Walsh. His book is The Texas Cowboy Cookbook. Coming up next, how grass-fed beef compares to the regular corn-fed variety. We'll tell you how to cook it coming right up. Hearing the words grass-fed beef. For an in-depth conversation on the subject, we turn to Jo Robinson. She runs the website eatwild.com, an incredible site devoted to grass-fed food. Hi, Jo.
Hi, Evan.
So what is, quote, normal store-bought beef fed?
Well, about 98% of the beef in this country comes from calves that are raised on pasture for maybe 6 to 8 months, and then they're shipped to a central area and held in large pens where there's no grass whatsoever. And they're fattened on a diet of concentrate, which can include anything, really, that fattens the animal and keeps it healthy long enough to go to market. But the primary ingredients would be grain and soy.
What is the difference in the meat itself between grass-fed and these grain-fed animals?
It is healthier in just about every way you can look at it. It has less total fat, less saturated fat, more unsaturated fat. And in particular, it has more omega-3 fatty acids, which is something we're used to thinking only coming from fish.
So all of these differences in the meat itself, do they make a difference in how we approach cooking?
It depends on who raised the beef, because it takes longer to fatten a cow on grass, on grain. And if the grass is kind of moderate, it's not really lush, it might take 2 years for the animal or 3 years for the animal to fatten. So the meat's a little bit older, so the fibers are a little tougher. And if there's less fat, then you need to cook it more slowly at a lower temperature in order to get the same tenderness.
Just to give us a comparison, at what age are corn-fed beef usually slaughtered?
Between 14 and 16 months. So they're very young.
So if we're cooking grass-fed beef and we want to cook it slower, yet we want to have a steak instead of like a braised part of the animal, like
right,
a brisket or a chuck, would we also cook a steak more slowly?
Yes, you would. But you want to have that browning, which really enhances the flavor. So what I recommend is that you brown both sides and then cook it at a much lower temperature for maybe twice as long. But, you know, you'll need to really check to see how done it is, because it's best when it's medium rare or even rare. It's juicier and much more tender at that point.
So do you tend to use the sort of restaurant technique of searing on the top of the stove and then throwing in the oven?
Yes, I do that. I also do it on the barbecue. And the way I do that is I put it right over the coals long enough to get both sides brown, and then I take it away from the direct heat and let it cook from the reflected heat for the rest of the time. And that's so you need to have the coals banked to one side of the grill.
This idea of feeding cattle grain, finishing them on grain, we didn't always do it this way, did we?
For a very long time, people have given some grain at the end of the animal's lifespan to add a little more fat. I think that's gone, you know, back for thousands of years. But what we now do is that we take them completely out of their natural environment, and we take away all of the greens completely, and then we feed them this highly concentrated, high-energy, dense, grain-based diet, which they're really not adapted to digest. In fact, it makes them sick. It has to be introduced slowly, and you have to accompany it with antibiotics or these bacteria form in the digestive system that get to the liver and destroy the liver. So it's a very abnormal feeding practice, and it requires medications in order for the animal to stay alive and be well.
Aside from our local farmers markets here in Southern California, where can we find grass-fed meat?
My website, eatwild.com, has the largest national directory of grass-based farmers. And when you go to the site, you can click on your state. And also, we have another section called Beyond the Farm. It's in the right margin. You can see the farmers markets, the retail stores, and the restaurants that feature grass-fed meat.
I think a lot of people are reluctant to make the switch because they're afraid that that full mouth feel, that richness that they're used to getting from a steak in particular, let's say, won't be there in a grass-fed animal. Is there a way that you sort of teach people to get used to grass-fed beef?
I have done two national taste tests where ranchers from all over the country have sent me, you know, the very same kind of steak, and I've tested it with food critics and chefs. And to be very honest, the first time that we had this was about 3 years ago, the steaks ran the whole gamut from being gamey and dry and really quite tough to being sumptuous and tender and extremely flavorful. The second time I did the test, which was 2 years later, there were very few steaks that were in that you don't want to eat it category. It's a matter of art and science, and more the grass farmers are learning how to make a really wonderful steak out of grass alone.
It's really an incredible sight. You've done an amazing service for all of us. Thank you very much, Joe.
Well, you're very welcome. I'm happy to talk about it.
That was Joe Robinson. She's the founder of EatWild.com, the most comprehensive listing of grass-fed foods in America. Sign up for our weekly Good Food newsletter and find every week's show. You can stream Good Food, download Good Food, and watch video episodes as well. Find it all on kcrw.com/goodfood. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Masiha. Special thanks to Beth Xavier. I'm Evan Kleiman. Don't forget to join me next week for a live edition of Good Food with lots of premiums.